It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Pope Benedict made headlines around the world over the weekend when he said there were times when the use of condoms might be permitted. This was widely interpreted as a radical shift in church teaching. But on Sunday, the Vatican rushed to clarify what the Pope meant. NPR's Silvia Poggioli is covering this story from Rome. Hi, Silvia.
Hi, Steve.
I suppose we should start with the Pope's actual words. What did he say?
He said, there may be a basis in the case of some individuals, as perhaps when a male prostitute uses a condom, where this can be a first assumption of responsibility to not spread infection. Now, this is a very circumscribed and nuanced view, but given the Catholic Church's longstanding ban on the use of any form of artificial contraception, the Pope's remarks were immediately hailed positively in many parts of the world most stricken by AIDS.
Would you explain where it was that the Pope was speaking in this way?
It's a book-length interview with a German journalist, Peter Seewald, that's due out this week, and the Vatican released some excerpts. But the Vatican caused confusion by issuing differing translations, which made the remarks appear stronger than they were. The Italian version said there may be some justified cases and spoke of a female prostitute. In any case, the remarks contrast with what Benedict said in March 2009 on a trip to Africa, where he said not only is the distribution of condoms not the answer to the AIDS epidemic, condoms actually increase the problem.
So Pope Benedict made this statement, a very carefully nuanced statement suggesting that condoms may be acceptable in some limited circumstances. That's what everyone understood the statement to mean eventually. Is the Vatican standing by that statement now that it's been clarified a little bit?
Well, Father Federico Lombardi, the spokesman, issued a statement saying the Pope's remarks are not a revolutionary shift. He stressed Benedict does not regard condoms as a real or moral solution to the problem of AIDS, but he also pointed out that there are numerous prelates who argue similar positions as Benedict in the interview. For example, many African church officials say condom use is worth considering when one partner in a marriage is HIV positive. And in fact, the Vatican has never issued an outright ban on the use of condoms to prevent AIDS. But what's striking is that this position comes directly from the Pope and therefore carries greater authority.
Can I just mention, it's rather remarkable that you would have the Pope talking about male prostitutes here and not, people might expect him simply to condemn the practice, to condemn what the person is doing, but he seems to be taking a far more subtle view of this.
Well, that's the point. But again, there's this confusion in the German and English version. He talks about a male prostitute. The Italian version talks about a female prostitute. And actually, what many prelates are saying is the issue about when you have a married couple where one of the partners is HIV positive.
How did it happen that the Pope put out a book that was basically him being interviewed?
Well, it's seen as his attempt at damage control following the many crises and PR failures that have marked his papacy. Other issues he talks about are the clerical sex abuse crisis. Benedict says that victims must be given priority, the church must deal with perpetrators, and introduce stricter screening for future priests. Another chapter deals with Benedict's strong defense of his predecessor, the controversial wartime Pope Pius XII, whose silence during the Holocaust has been widely criticized by Jewish leaders and many historians. Benedict describes Pius as one of the great righteous men, and this could be a signal that he intends to go ahead with Pius's beatification and eventual sainthood.
That's NPR's Silvia Poggioli bringing us the latest on Pope Benedict's remarks. Silvia, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Some of the government's biggest obligations are in Medicare. 2 million baby boomers could sign up for Medicare prescription drug coverage before the end of this year, as Kelly Weiss reports.
Seniors can have a tough time choosing Medicare Part D plans for drug coverage, so they often recruit savvy family members.
Yeah, I was in the banking business.
That's Scott Matei, and he's talking about doing real estate appraisals, to be exact, which he says is not like helping his mother-in-law enroll in Medicare.
I couldn't relate it. It's more complex than that.
He and his mother-in-law, Marcia Muller, are at the University of the Pacific Pharmacy School's free Medicare enrollment event in a suburb outside of Sacramento. Muller says she takes 9 medications.
I just need to find the best way to spend my money. You know, I don't have a lot of money. I'm retired, on Social Security.
One expert at the event, Margaret Riley, works for a nonprofit in Sacramento that helps explain Medicare benefits. Riley says Congress created offices like hers around the country.
I think signing up for Medicare is a little bit like being in purgatory, and you need somebody to help you get out of there.
This year, here's what Riley's telling seniors. They'll see fewer Part D plans because of the new federal health care law. California, for example, had 47 last year, and now there's 30. And Riley says most seniors won't have a copay for many preventive services.
The bone density test, prostate cancer screening for men. There's now actually more of an annual physical. Doctors are going to be busy.
About 3 million seniors will have to choose new Medicare Advantage plans because the old ones don't offer all the benefits required under new federal regulations. And Riley says there's now a discount for seniors who take expensive brand name drugs and fall into the infamous donut hole.
In 2011, if you reach the gap, right now folks are paying 100% of the cost of that medicine. But next year, they'll pay 50%, and the plan will pay 50%, and they'll move through the gap at the same rate without paying the same amount of money.
Okay, so we know about some of the changes and one way to get help, but there's another option.
Let's take it all the way back, Jeff, and we'll put your zip code in here. Okay, then Ross Blair
is the CEO of Plan Prescriber. He's at a Sacramento call center with Jeff Orwig, going through Plan Prescriber's website that compares Medicare plans. Orwig, self-employed, turns 65 next month and takes four pricey prescription drugs.
I've had open-heart surgery, so my health insurance over the years has been very expensive.
He says the official Medicare.gov website is frustrating.
Well, it's sort of a joke for me because three different times it wouldn't even let me on the site to decipher what I wanted to learn.
Last year, Blair says 1.5 million people used his website, one of several designed to help seniors. He says it's a free service because insurers pay Plan Prescriber a commission for new customers. After plugging in Orwig's medications, Blair goes over the costs.
And you can see the savings range anywhere from $500 up to $3,200 a year. Not all plans are created equal, and it's really important to look at all the alternatives that are available out there.
Pharmacists stress seniors should reevaluate their plans each year to make sure they're getting the lowest price. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Weiss in Sacramento.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. This is the season for people to talk about reducing the federal deficit. Just after Thanksgiving, a presidential commission is supposed to offer a plan. Other groups have already submitted their ideas. And on NPR News in recent days, Republicans as well as Democrats have offered their views. Budget expert Joe Minerick says it's a tough debate because many people don't get the basics, like the difference between the deficit and the national debt, which is now in the trillions of dollars.
It's very clear that a lot of people don't understand it. I've been in meetings on Capitol Hill when people have used the terms interchangeably.
I'm sorry, on Capitol Hill where they do the budget?
Yeah, it happens.
Joe Minerick worked in the Clinton administration and is now with the Committee for Economic Development, which seeks to represent a centrist point of view. For the record, the deficit is how much the U.S. spends beyond its income in any one year. The national debt refers to the obligations that build up over time. They've built up into the trillions of dollars.
The scale of the debt is what we normally look at, and we measure the debt against our gross domestic product. We have shot through kind of an imaginary line. It's arbitrary, but budget wonks like myself are concerned at a debt of about 60% of the GDP.
If the debt of the country is about 60% of the size of the annual income of the country, that seems like a manageable amount of debt.
If you could hold it there, yes. At this point, the debt has shot through that level, and we're still growing very rapidly.
I want to make sure I understand a little better the deficits and the debts that we have. I may run a big deficit one year when I borrow a bunch of money to buy a house, which anybody would see as an investment for which you have long-term value. It's a reasonable kind of borrowing. There's other kinds of borrowing that'd be bad. If I borrow money to pay off a credit card bill, very, very bad sounding. Is there any way when you look at a $1 trillion federal deficit like we have now to say some of that is good debt for which we're getting lasting value, it's an investment, and some of it is bad debt? Can you divide it up that way at all?
Imagine that the money that you charged on your credit card that you can't pay this month was to pay the roofer because there was a hole in the roof and water was coming in.
Okay.
You paid him because the water was going to do a lot more damage than the cost of fixing the roof right now. So yes, you ran a deficit. It may be that it's going to take you 5 years to pay it. But in the end, you avoided a worse consequence.
And I suppose the problem is that having run a couple of $1 trillion deficits, we're still trying to fix the roof here.
That's right. And you can get to the point where you are in a vicious cycle. The debt chases the deficit, chases the debt.
Let me ask you about some political arguments that are made over the deficit and debt. Many Democrats will say a large reason for the deficits are President Bush's tax cuts. There's now a debate over whether to renew some or all of those tax cuts. Could you fix this problem simply by raising taxes, letting them go back to the Clinton-era taxes? Could you do this by tax policy alone?
Not fully, no. Going back to the Clinton tax rates might solve a third of it, not only the upper income portion, but also the portion for people.
Take back everybody's tax cut.
That's right. And that would not solve the problem all by itself.
Let's look at the other side. Many Republicans will say we're taxed plenty enough already. This is not a taxing problem. It's a spending problem. Could you realistically fix this problem through spending cuts?
And the answer to that one is no as well. Listening to what people are saying about, I want a smaller government, but usually what comes after the but is don't cut my Social Security benefits, don't cut defense. You take a few of those things off the table and you don't have enough left to eliminate the deficit.
If I'm sitting here thinking about our original concepts, I got the deficit, which is a problem at the moment, and I got the debt, which is a cumulative problem over time. Do I have to get the deficit down to zero in order to start paying down the debt?
In order to start paying down the debt in dollars, yes. However, if you get to the point where the deficit as a percentage of the GDP is lower than the rate at which the economy is growing.
So it's like I'm getting a better paying job. I have a little more capacity to take on debt, even if I'm still building up extra debt in absolute terms.
The peak of the debt as a percentage of the GDP was at the end of World War II, 109-point-something% of GDP. The lowest level was 1974, I think 23.25% of GDP. Over those 28 years, the budget was balanced 8 times.
Most of the time there were deficits.
But the deficits were smaller as a percentage of GDP than the rate of growth of the GDP.
Does that give some cause for optimism here in that you don't have to eliminate the whole deficit, just get it down, get it down?
It certainly does make the job look easier if you can explain that if, you know, you've already gotten the deficit down small enough that at least our debt is not going to be growing faster than our income anymore, then people might say, well, okay, let's do it.
Joe Minerick of the Committee for Economic Development, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Now the latest in our series, My Guilty Pleasure, where writers talk about books they're embarrassed to admit they love. Today, an erotic novel of exacting historical detail set during the English Civil War of the 1640s. The book is called As Meat Loves Salt by Maria McCann. Here's author Lionel Shriver to explain why it is her guilty pleasure.
I remember when I first idly opened As Meat Loves Salt over my morning coffee. I had other plans for that day, yet after about 10 pages, I put those plans aside, indulging myself. I curled into a living room armchair and galloped on as the sun rose high. In my easily distracted adulthood, I have rarely, alas, said this of any novel, but I could not put it down. As Meat Loves Salt is narrated by a brooding, intermittently violent young man named Jacob, who does not know himself. In flight from a murder and a brief disastrous marriage, he joins the new model army, led by the parliamentarian Oliver Cromwell, from which he and his new friend Ferris eventually go AWOL. It isn't until halfway through the novel that Jacob realizes, and we realize, that the tension between Jacob and Ferris is sexual, and they embark upon a torrid affair. Yet in the 1640s, the mild, accepting term gay had yet to be coined. Bookshops didn't have whole sections cheerfully devoted to gay literature. Rather, homosexuality was a hanging offense. Jacob and Ferris's passionate, fractious relationship courts calamity. I happen to be straight and female. Yet McCann's novel, to my incredulity, her first, is one of the most erotic I have ever read. But it isn't, like so much erotic literature, embarrassing. Her language is carefully couched in the terms of the time, without ever seeming fusty, coy, or obscure. We know perfectly well what she means when she writes, "His blood was up." Moreover, the historical details are seamlessly interwoven into the text, and rather than seem to show off how much homework the author has done, They create the sense of immediacy that I always need to get hooked by a historical novel. After all, the past was once the present. Thus McCann has written a Tony version of We Were There at the English Civil War. Ever since reading this book, I felt curiously proprietary about the conflict, as if I truly know what it was like, as if I were there. Apparently Maria McCann was a schoolteacher when she wrote this novel, and used to get up at 5 a.m. every weekday to write a few more pages. But so professional was her work that when her editor showed her manuscript to an expert on the period, the only error the historian discovered was a particular postal vehicle, which wasn't used until a few years later. That's pretty high marks.
The book is called As Meat Loves Salt by Maria McCann. It's the guilty pleasure of Lionel Shriver, whose latest novel is titled So Much for That.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Alyssa Block. By now, we've learned not to expect privacy on company-issued computers and cell phones. If your employer owns a device, he controls it. But what about your personal smartphone? As NPR's Martin Costi reports, your employer may have some remote control over that, too.
Amanda Stanton found out the hard way. Traveling in L.A. for work, she was navigating with her iPhone.
And the phone went black. It just turned into a brick.
Everything was gone. All her contacts, her photos, even her phone's ability to make calls. It was only after she got home to Silicon Valley that she found out that her phone had been killed by her employer.
It was a huge shock.
An IT guy had sent out what's called a remote wipe. It's a kind of auto-destruct command delivered by email. The wipe was done by mistake, and Stanton wouldn't have been surprised to see this kind of remote control on a company phone, but this iPhone was hers.
My account in my name, I'd paid all the bills. It didn't make any sense to me that somehow work could get through AT&T, who I thought controlled my phone, and could completely disable the phone and the account.
But to the people at your IT department, this is old news. The moment you set up your phone to get email from a Microsoft Exchange server, which most big companies use, that server is able to send commands to your phone. And not just remote wipes. Depending on the phone, an IT person could turn off your Bluetooth signal, your web browser, even your phone's camera.
Different organizations want those controls.
Adam Glick, senior technical product manager for Microsoft Exchange, says these commands make a phone more secure. And it is true that if your smartphone is ever stolen, you'll likely be relieved that your IT people can send a command wiping the memory. As to remote control over other functions, like the camera, Glick says employers sometimes need those to prevent leaks.
If you're having an important meeting about the future finances of the organization, and people put that up on a slide, and someone might take out their camera phone and take a picture, and then they might go and, say, post it to the internet.
Anthony Davis runs IT for a manufacturing company in Seattle, and he says he makes a point of letting people know that when they opt to get company email on their personal phones, they're opting into more than just email.
We actually have a one-page waiver that says, you know, if you're going to connect your personal phone to the corporate email system, that we do have the capability, if the phone is lost, to remote wipe it, and we will, and then have the employee, you know, agree and sign to that form.
Louis Maltby, president of the National Work Rights Institute, says he's not sure what a court would say about a company that wipes an employee's phone without permission, but he'd sure like to find out.
I'm salivating right now at the prospect of this lawsuit.
And it's not just phones. IT administrators can send similar commands to iPads and other personal devices that get work email. Maltby says we're seeing a breakdown of the old paradigm that work controls work devices and you control yours.
Now you have this gray world in which everything overlaps and everything that's personal is also business and vice versa. And now it's a mess.
Putting work email on a personal device may be convenient, but for Amanda Stanton, it's no longer worth the risk. After restoring her iPhone, she says she'll never put work email on it again. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
Down at the Homestead Miami Speedway yesterday, Jimmy Johnson started the day looking, well, human. Johnson had already won a record 4 straight NASCAR championships, but heading into the season's final race, he was 15 points behind leader Denny Hamlin. Hamlin did lead Johnson at points during the race, but he couldn't hold on. And in the end, the day belonged to Jimmy Johnson.
The championship is going to go to Jimmy Johnson, and if you don't think he's going to be one of the greatest, think
you're
again.
You're looking at the 5-time champion.
You're looking at him.
That's a very excited Jimmy Johnson winning his 5th NASCAR Sprint Cup Championship. Well, on the line now is Lee Spencer. She's senior NASCAR writer for FoxSports.com. And Lee Spencer, 5 straight championships. No driver in NASCAR history has done that. How good was he?
Oh, my. He was just, he was absolutely amazing. He could find a line, make the most of it, get around the racetrack, make it seem absolutely effortless. And that's just part of what makes Jimmy Johnson so good. I asked him yesterday, how much does experience mean to you, having the experience to win championship after championship after championship? And he said, experience is everything. And boy, they proved it again on Sunday.
Well, now give us a little bit of perspective here for people who don't follow NASCAR closely. How would this translate if you were trying to talk about another sport? Is this the equivalent of winning 5 straight Grand Slams in tennis, or what would be the comparison?
Well, when you look at dynasties in sports, certainly you have the Celtics. They won 11 championships in 13 years. The Steelers back in the 70s, 4 Super Bowls in 6 years. The Yankees, 6 titles in 8 years. But when you look at consecutive seasons and to put it together now, when the sport is as tough as it's ever been, when competition is as tough as it's ever been, what he's been able to accomplish is just miraculous.
Well, how does he do it? What is it about Jimmy Johnson that makes him better than the other drivers out there?
I think he is just so relaxed in his own skin. He told us a story yesterday about getting up for the driver introductions. In his competition, Denny Hamlin starting to say, boy, I'm starting to feel the butterflies. That never hit Jimmy Johnson because he had been there before. He knew what it takes to capitalize, to take adversity, turn it around, and make it his own. In 9 years, he has 53 wins and 327 starts, and they just keep producing success over and over again.
Let me ask you, one hates to look for a dark lining in all of this, but I wonder, is it perhaps bad for the sport to have one driver be so dominant? Does it get a little boring?
Well, I think, you know, in some perspectives it does, because there's 43 drivers every week, which means there are, you know, 43 different groups of fans. Obviously, some are bigger than others, and you know, there might be people that get tired of seeing that, but you know, I can't remember back in the Michael Jordan days that people got tired of watching, you know, Michael play. To be around a guy like Jimmy Johnson, who's just, you know, an awesome guy. He had his first child this year. He's married to a former model. I mean, he really does have the perfect life.
And he's living the life.
He really is. And, you know, I couldn't be happier for him.
Well, thanks very much, Lee Spencer.
We really appreciate your time.
That's Lee Spencer. She's senior NASCAR writer for FoxSports.com, and she's been talking about Jimmy Johnson, who just won a record 5th straight NASCAR championship.
You're listening to All Things Considered.